This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, mobile web development, and so much more. Show's hosted by me, I'm Dan Benjamin, and of course, by Marco Arment, the creator of Instapaper, among other things, who's back today. I want to say thanks very much to our sponsors, Textastic. New one we'll tell you about as we go on. Tap Typing. And finally, Squarespace.com. More about all of those as the show continues. Hey, Marco, welcome back. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you. This is big.
Big news for the people who don't...
Big week?
Yeah, but huge week. Come on. For people who don't know, I don't know how they don't know this, if they missed it somehow, because we've only been talking about it every week for months, your baby is here.
That's right.
This is big time. So you had the baby. Baby's healthy. And
yep.
Your wife
is
healthy.
He's healthy. Everyone's good.
Congratulations.
And we're almost getting sleep. It's really fantastic.
Yeah. Like I said, you'll be getting sleep almost immediately. I'm 4.5 years in. I'm almost able to sleep through the nights with my kids that wake up.
That's great. Yeah. That seems pretty, that doesn't seem bad at all.
No, not bad at all.
That. It's a good thing that I'm really good at making coffee because, this is like now I know exactly how to use coffee to maximize my my abilities.
This is how a real addiction starts, I think, right?
Right. Well, right.
Like, I can control it. I can stop anytime I want.
Well, it's like because now I know, I actually am drinking less coffee now than I did before because I know that I have to get sleep when I can. And I know that, if I don't fall asleep at 10 o'clock at night, I'm not going to get sleep till 3 in the morning. Because there's these intervals of feeding and everything. So I know that, if I have coffee at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, that's not very good. Because that could cause issues.
Yeah.
I feel like it's sleep. So I'm down from 2 cups a day to 1 cup a day. And I'm even using less so that if I get a chance to take an afternoon nap, so I'm down from 12 grams to 8 grams of beans in the AeroPress. Just because I know that, I want to wake myself up for this and for a few hours to get some stuff done and to be awake and, play with my new son and everything. But when he falls asleep, I want to be able to take a nap also. And so far, I haven't done that because now we're going to have a whole stream of episodes, probably for years, about how the heck to work at home or work for yourself while you have a kid. Because, one of my... somebody in my life who doesn't know what I do, I forget who it was already because my brain is melted, but somebody asked me, do you get a lot of paternity leave? And, well, I kind of have infinitely long paternity leave and none at the same time. Because when you work for yourself, no one's covering for me. I don't really... I can take off as much time as I want, but... The more time I take off from my obligations, the less healthy my business becomes in the long term. So it's weird. It's a difficult business, and I can see how workaholism really could become a problem for people who are trying to raise a family but work for themselves or work at home, where you're kind of always able to work. And that's even that being able to always work and being always connected, that's applying to more and more people, even people who don't work for themselves, as businesses give everybody BlackBerries and expect these things. They expect people to be responding to email in the evenings and on the weekends and stuff. So I think this is going to be a difficult balance that I will have to figure out. And I'm sure you've fought this too as well. I mean, haven't you had these same issues? Because you work at home for... You've worked at home for a long time, right?
Yeah, a very, very long time. And it is an ongoing challenge. Every single day is a challenge. And now I'm at the point where I would, for a long time, I cherished the concept and the idea of being at home because I could see my little boy, who's 4.5 now, I could see him, constantly. And then all of a sudden, he started, like crawling around, but really running around and climbing stairs and all kinds of things. And, as they get older and bigger and they play, they get louder, they get, and more things start to happen. So it became a much, much, much bigger challenge than it was when you could put them down on their little blanket on the ground and they would just sort of sit there and look at toys and stuff. you know, when they're mobile and they're running around and they have things that dad, can look, watch dad. You know, it changes, you know, and you, but the thing is, you love that and you want to respond to them.
Right.
You want to, when they say, dad, look, want to see what I can do? You do want to see what they can do. So it becomes a challenge that way. Now, you know, my little baby girl, she's just about 9 months old. So she's in that stage where, you know, it's easier to sort of manage what they do and where, but now she's crawling. So, you know, you're there and you're struggling. The biggest struggle is almost internal. You want to be with them. You hear them. You know that they're having fun. You want to go have fun with them. The secondary problem is, man, they're noisy. What do I do about that?
I mean, that's a bigger problem for your business, I imagine.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's much easier if you are a typical... And when I was, you know, again, 4 years ago, I wasn't doing this full time. I could do a show in a time when I knew he'd be sleeping or something, and it was scheduling around it was easier. And if you're like a developer, you can put on white noise or music or headphones or noise canceling things or whatever, and you can manage that much more easily. So it's, but no matter what, it's tricky. It's a challenge,
right?
Huge challenge.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so that's going to be, I think, an ongoing theme here for us from this point forward.
Yeah.
We've talked about it a little bit in the past, but I think now I'm going to face a lot more of these challenges. So naturally, I'm going to talk about them. I will say I still like my car, and I still don't want a minivan. The car seat fits awesomely in my 328. There's plenty of backseat space. It's not easy to get it in and out. I had like the professional, the police station certified the installation and tightened it down even further for me and everything. Which
How were you tightening it down before the cop showed you how to do it?
I had read, and for people, it seems like a lot of people don't know that this is possible, at least in the U.S., if you search for car seat inspections, you get some page of the national DOT or something like that. And they give you like a list of states and you pick your state and it'll tell you by zip code or anything all the different places around you that you can get a free child car seat inspection. And usually it's like police and fire stations. And so I had read about how, you know, most people don't tighten it enough at all because it's really not supposed to move much at all.
I've read that it's supposed to move less than 2 inches when you pull it as hard as you can to either side.
Like
maybe it's even less than that.
Something like that, yeah. And only the front should move, not the back. Like the back is the part that's actually strapped down to the seat. That should barely budge at all, if not, you know, if anything. So I read that when the people do these inspections, that they like put their whole weight on, they put their knee on the base and really tighten it down. So I tried doing that before I got there, just because I wanted to be the guy who did it right before I got there. So I did. I tightened it way, way down. It still rocked slightly. By the latch strap, it could still rock like a half an inch in either direction. And we get there, and the cop's like, oh, okay, not bad, but watch this. And then he gets in there, does pretty much the same thing as I did, but I think he was putting his knee a little bit in a little bit different spot to get a little bit more leverage. And wow, when he did it, it does not move at all on the back end. The front end, which is really not anchored down, will move slightly. But the back by like the butt of the seat, like for the adult butt title, the back does not budge at all. So it's pretty good. And I will say again, my car was awesome. I had the latch hooks right there. You know, I've heard like a lot of cars have the latch hooks kind of difficult to reach, or they're buried down too low, or they're at weird angles. Mine was awesome. I had no problems at all.
My tip for this, Marco, would be if you're trying this at home, would be to if you can do it. So the knee can kind of work. My advice, though, is to if you can do it, stand in it. Put 100% of your weight in it.
You just want me to buy a minivan so I can do that.
No, I mean I used to do that in before we had the minivan, and stand in it, not standing upright, but I mean like put your feet in it, and you may be crouching position, but standing in it. And then tighten it down. And you know, if you weigh, you know, $150, you're going to be putting a lot of weight. If you weigh less than that, push on the ceiling. You'll get that thing tight.
Yeah.
Because eventually you're going to have to take this thing out and do it again yourself.
Right, exactly.
Something will happen. A drink will spill. Something will happen where you'll have to take this thing out. Yeah. And it'll, you know.
Well, hopefully, I mean, this is the rear-facing one because he's a newborn. Hopefully, the next time I'm hoping I can keep that base in there for a year. And then when he's one, we're supposed to flip it around and get a front-facing one. Anyway.
Maybe he won't be big enough to need it.
Yeah, somebody told me I said anyway way too much, so now I'm all self-conscious about that.
Don't worry.
That's my official
who cares what they say?
Sentence ender or topic ender. Man, I'm really glad that I'm not doing public speaking right now. Like I don't have any conference speaking gigs booked because my last one went so badly. I don't know if I want to do it anymore. It was rough. I was thinking about this when Merlin. Amazingly, I have actually caught up with almost all of your shows over the week. But one thing I loved was the latest Back to Work episode when Merlin was talking about how he loved writing, but he didn't like writing a book. Roughly paraphrased, that's basically what he said. Like, he loved writing, but when it came time to write an entire book, he said something along the lines of, like, he loved writing 5,000 words about something, but not 75,000 words about something, especially about a topic he didn't like very much anymore. And I love that whole segment of the show. You should really listen to it. We should put it in the show notes. Well, not you. I know you listened to it. You were there. You had to be there. It's really, really good. And that's how I feel about a lot of things. And I've come to learn that. And I love writing, but I don't think I could ever write a book. It just sounds like it takes everything I love about writing and throws it away. I want to make a blog post about this, but that's the gist of it, is that like I love that segment. And part of that is that I thought that I should also get into speaking at conferences because I'm kind of in that market. Like I'm the kind of person who speaks at conferences, I guess. But I've done it. I've spoken at, I think, 3 conferences now. Well, kind of 3.5. And the first ones went well. The last one went pretty badly. And
why do you feel that it went so badly? Or why is that your takeaway?
First of all,
the booing and the people getting up and walking out, or
I don't, oh man. I don't know who thought this was a good idea. I don't want to call them out because they're nice people. But the last conference I spoke at, they send the speakers a score from like the audience ratings after the conference is over.
Oh.
And they send you...
Well, that's so you can improve as a speaker.
Right.
For the next
and they send you your score, and then they show you everyone else's scores but without the names attached to them. So
right.
You can't tell who got what score, but you can tell where you ranked relative to everyone else. And I had by far the lowest score. And I was even told about this by some of the other speakers who had spoken there before. I was told about it beforehand, so I was expecting this email. And even then, when they told me about it, I'm like, that's a terrible idea. I don't want to see my feedback. That's not good. But yeah, I was last place. And by a pretty, like, the last place and the second to last place had a pretty big gap between them. I think I got like a 3.5 out of 5 or something like that. But it was, everyone else was in the 4s. Like it was a big gap. And you know, but the reason it went, even before I got that, I thought it went badly. I could tell in the room it went badly because I'm not a very good speaker. You know, I know that.
You seem to speak well here and on the show.
Well, here you tolerate my flaws. And I guess the audience does too, otherwise they wouldn't stick around. But I'm not a very good speaker. And I'm especially not good at the kind of speaking, at the kind of talk that I was asked to give there, which was kind of like an applied practices kind of conference. And, you know, so it's like, here's how you do these cool things in CSS, and here's why you should do this cool designy thing, and then me talking about apps. And I couldn't talk about the business of apps really because no one there was in the business of apps. So I had to talk about, different ways that apps interact with web technologies and how you use web views and some things you should do and things you shouldn't do and how to choose and everything. It was more of like a tutorial kind of talk relative to my other talks, which are more like business big picture stuff, more like what I talk about here. This talk was so different from that, and it was such a terrible match to the audience, but I wasn't really qualified to talk to this audience about anything else. And so, because they're talking about like web development, they're talking about like SAS and less CSS and all this stuff that I don't even use. And these are all like web designers. I'm not a web designer, not even close. And so it was a very bad match with me to the audience. But I realized even leading up to it, I was dreading this talk even before I gave it. I knew it was going to be a difficult match, and I didn't enjoy it. And I was getting paid. It was the first time I had a paid speaking gig. I mean, the other ones, they would like fly me out somewhere, which is nice. But this one, they flew me out and they paid me.
Wrote a check.
Yeah, they actually wrote a check. But it wasn't like all the money in the world wouldn't have made up for the stress I felt leading up to this, the anxiety I had about giving the talk, and then afterwards knowing that it wasn't very good. Even before I got that scorecard, knowing it wasn't very good afterwards, that was very damaging to me. And so I want to take a break now and not talk for a while at conferences, and maybe start small, like at user groups or something, if I want to get back into it. But maybe I'm just not a good conference speaker. Like maybe I should just like Merlin realized he doesn't actually like writing books very much. You know, maybe I just really don't like speaking at conferences as much as I think I should like it. Or as much as I like it in theory, in practice, I've been so ridiculously stressed out every time I've done it. And I like going to conferences. You know, I like attending them. But maybe I'm just better to be in the audience seat and not be up there. Maybe that's better for my overall health, regardless of, you know, even if I had a better suited gig for what I actually can talk about, I think the podcast medium here is so much more my style than going up on stage, preparing this big slide deck, talking for 45 minutes or an hour to an audience of people who paid a lot of money or had their bosses pay a lot of money to be there and are expecting something that maybe I can't deliver or maybe I'm just not even good at delivering.
You know, there are probably people in the audience now who are saying, man, I really wish Dan would encourage him to speak more and to say, oh, practice makes perfect. And, you know, you probably are a really great speaker, but you just haven't done it enough. And it's good to fail. And it's good to go through that experience. But here's what I'm going to say. If you don't like doing it, then maybe you don't need to do it.
That's the thing. I really don't like doing it. I like doing this show, you know, and so... You know, it's not, I don't think it's an issue about public speaking necessarily, because this show reaches far more people
right.
than any other conferences
I've But you're also at. In, it's almost like that I'm driving in my car kind of thing, in that you're in your car and you're not aware that there's other people there. And that's why, like, sometimes you see people doing things they would never
right,
do.
They pick their nose.
Right. Yeah. So right now you're safely ensconced in your, you know, private office in your mansion and, you know, you have people bringing coffee in and things like, so it doesn't feel like you're in front
of. You think I would let somebody else make my coffee?
I think at some point you're going to have to.
I brought coffee making stuff to the hospital.
So this is the thing. If all of a sudden all of the people who are listening to this show were listening live and you were in a room in front of them, even if it was just like you and me sitting up there, you might feel differently about that.
If it was me and you sitting at a table on a stage talking like this, every week in a big auditorium for free.
Yeah.
I'd be fine with that. I think that
that would be fun.
A conference talk is a completely different medium than this. It really is. It's supposed to be this one, you know, coherent storyline with the arc and with these certain elements. You have to prepare a lot of things in advance.
A lot of preparation.
It takes hours and hours of preparation in advance to just make the slides and figure out what you're going to say. Then you have to rehearse it if you're any good. You have to rehearse it. And then you're going to find things that don't work that you want to change. And, you know, a lot of the people who spoke at the conference are people who speak at conferences professionally, like on a regular basis. That's what they do.
The Merlin Manns of the world, right?
Right. Many times they will have given that same talk before somewhere else or a relative of that same talk before somewhere else. Whereas what I was doing was, I'm not a public speaker by profession. I'm not particularly good at it. And I don't speak enough to have a lot of practice, and I don't speak enough to have a whole bunch of material to draw from previous talks, or to be able to repeat a talk to multiple audiences and really refine it. So I was kind of doing the worst of everything. It's like, you know, I had to build everything from scratch every time I gave a talk for, you know, twice a year, and it just the stress just wasn't worth it. But anyway, topic ender. Anyway,
yeah. Anyway. But here's the thing. Hold on a second. Okay. You did it though.
I told you we had a lot to talk about today.
I know. But you did this thing. You went up there, you did it, and you've done it multiple times. So there's nobody out there who should say, well, he doesn't have the courage to do it. You sure do. You did it. And you've done it, and you've done it a few times, and your takeaway from having done it a few times was that maybe you don't want to do it anymore. So give Marco a break. Give him a break.
And it would like the first two or three that I did that went well, I thought after that, wow, I'm kind of glad I did this. This was fun. My favorite one was Webstock. That was so much fun. But after this one went badly, even before I started this one, I told you, you know, I was not happy with the situation even before I got on stage. I knew this was a bad match. I knew it was not going to go well. And I tried my best to make it something that would go well, but it still didn't. After that, I really regretted doing it. It was the first time I had done this where I said, you know, I wish that never happened. I wish I never even gave that talk. I wish I never even agreed to give to speak, you know, in this context, because I'm not the right person for it. But yeah, so maybe I don't know. I think I'm going to take a break, and I'll see if I ever want to do this again. I certainly think if I ever were to do it again, it would be a much smaller audience, and you'd probably never hear about it. Like, I'd probably go to some really small gig, warm up there, kind of like what stand-up comedians do. They, like, you know, test out new acts, you know, in these little tiny clubs somewhere,
right,
and eventually refine it and bring it to you, you know, the public on HBO or something. I really think I need to do something like that if I'm going to get back into this. But I might not even want to. So we'll see. Back to baby stuff, because we have a huge long list of stuff to talk about today.
Let's do one of our first sponsors then.
Yeah, definitely.
Because we'll break the show up into thirds with the sponsors. Textastic.
I have that app.
You do. It's a powerful and fast text editor for iPad. So this is what it is. How I want you to think of it anyway. It's an advanced code editor for the iPad. It has rich support for syntax highlighting. It does FTP, SFTP. It does Dropbox. It has like more than 80 different types of files that it understands. HTML, XML, Objective-C, PHP. I mean, all of the big ones, JavaScript, shell scripts even. And you can use your own because it's TextMate compatible syntax definitions. So if you already have things that you're using, you like TextMate, you're using those, guess what? Works with those. It's written from the ground up. So it has all of the native APIs that you like, core text, all of this. This is a really, really awesome text editor, but specifically a code editor. So it also has, I mentioned, FTP. It has SFTP. It'll do web dev. It'll do Dropbox. I mean, all of this stuff. It's all built into it. Really great interface. Really code-friendly interface. I mean, what more do you say? You use it? You like this thing, Marco? Is this something you use?
Yeah, I mean, I don't often have a need for it, but when I do, I'm glad it's there.
Yeah, that's the way you want to think about it. How many times you're out there, you've got your iPad, and you're, oh man, I got to do this. You may not sit down and develop in this 100% of your time, though I would say you probably could. You wouldn't have to, but it's there. It's there when you need it. It's one of these apps that, for me, is really indispensable because it's going to be there when you need it. Anyway, this is what you can do. You can go and you can find this thing online at Textastic app. I got to spell it. Textastic app.com. Or you can just search for that in the app store. So go check that thing out. Really cool. And let's make this guy happy to do sponsorship. If you're a developer and you've got an iPad, try this thing out. Textastic. It's Textastic, Marco.
Yep. So
and you already have it. I was going to give you a promo code. I've got some promo codes.
I give it to somebody else.
All right.
So, you know, one thing that I've noticed a lot with the baby being here, and keep in mind, I mean, the baby's only been here for a week, so anything I say, take with a grain of salt. Obviously, I'm not an expert yet, or anywhere close, and I don't know if anybody ever is. But I have found, and I... first of all, let me thank Daniel Jockett for doing the last show. That was really awesome. last week when I told Dan that I couldn't do the show because we were in the hospital giving birth, which is a pretty good reason, I asked him, I'm like, can you get Daniel Jalka to do a fill-in show? Because he'd be great. I like him. But he's tough to get. I mean, this guy, sure. It's like getting Brad Pitt. I mean, you know, look at how often he does his own podcast with Matt and Reese, you know, the Core Intuition podcast. That, as you mentioned on the show, they've done like two episodes in the last year or something like that.
Right.
And it's a great show. But, you know, this guy's hard to get. Obviously, this guy's like an A-lister, and you got him on my show.
Boom.
That's fantastic. So
boom.
I'm really glad he could do it.
Well, your idea. Come on.
Yeah. Hey, that's. I occasionally have good ideas when they don't involve conference speaking. turns out. With the baby stuff, I found that I have an even lower tolerance now for unreliable technology. And I tweeted about this when I had the Withings or Withings. How do you say that? Withings? I had the Withings baby monitor, which just came out, and it looks really cool, and it has this, you know, iOS app compatibility and everything. But it was unreliable as hell. It would, the video stream, it seemed like, as far as I can tell, even if you're on the same Wi-Fi network as it, it seems like it's relaying the video to its servers, round tripping it and coming back to
mm-hmm.
you.
Yeah.
Which causes a big delay and a pretty low frame rate and this pretty bad reliability issue where sometimes the video stream would just freeze. And the audio would continue, but the video stream would just freeze. And so you think you're watching your kid, but you're really not. And that's, you know, if I understand a lot of parents have told me, don't even bother with video monitors, just get audio because video will drive you crazy. That's fine. That's a separate argument. But if you have a video monitor and it's showing your kid in a certain position or, you know, or doing a certain thing, you expect that that's being accurate. And so that's a level of
right.
reliability.
If it's frozen, you're, oh, look, he's still asleep. Great.
Right.
Oh, look, he's still asleep. Why am I hearing him crying when he's clearly still asleep?
Right. So,
First of all, I can tell you
that monitor I would not recommend.
I would like to know if you found one that you like, because with my first kid, we didn't ever use a video monitor. And then with the second one, we just thought, okay, we'll get one. And the one that we've got, it's this Motorola one that doesn't do anything fancy. It has no, no like integration with anything. But it's like the top of the line.
I'll put video,
it,
right?
Yeah, video. I'll put it
is
in it, the show
does
notes.
It end in 36 model number?
Well, let's see here. It just says Motorola digital video baby monitor with color LCD screen.
It's like MP36 or something like that.
Yeah.
That's the one I have.
Okay.
Yeah, I got that instead. I like it a lot so far.
We're on our third.
I had it for a couple days. Oh.
periodically, what would happen is after the... So here's what happened with the first one. The first one that we got started getting darker and darker and darker till one point...
The video feed or just the screen itself?
The video. Okay. And till finally my wife's like... This seems a little dark. I'm like, it's pitch black. I'm like, she's like, well, it's dark in the room. I'm like, no, you know, it had night vision like a week ago. It worked fine. So I called him up, I went through Amazon return process, got another one sent out to us. Then that one, after a couple days, you would turn on the video display part and it would just immediately turn itself back off. It didn't matter if it was on battery or not on battery, plugged in or not. It would just turn. The third one, though, it seems like it's okay. The third one seems to be working. Okay.
Well, that's good. I'll let you know how mine goes.
Yeah.
I mean, functionally, it is so much better than the Withings monitor.
Yeah. MP386. Yeah, it's MP36. That's the one. You're right.
Yeah, and I think it was like $70 cheaper. It was like $230, and I think the Withings was $300.
Yeah, these are expensive. I mean, this is the top of the line video baby monitor. We did the first one we have, and I'll even put the audio one in there because that one has been like rock solid reliable. And if you don't want video, that I have an audio one to recommend. But you're actually saying you like this one better.
I like it a lot better than the Withings. I mean, first of all, the Withings, it's only the camera. You don't get a video monitor. The idea is you use an iOS device of your choice or multiple iOS devices as the video monitors. The problem with that is that then, you know, if you're using your phone, well, then you're draining your phone's battery
right.
more than you need to. Or you know, if you have an extra iOS device around, then you can do that. That's fine. But that's still something else you have to keep charged. That's, you know, separate from the video monitor. And I mean, and this, so the Motorola thing has its own standalone video monitor. It's proprietary, you know, 2.4 gigahertz wireless, you know, all done. And it is something else that needs to be kept charged, but it's a dedicated device. And I really like dedicated devices because they, you know, to, as Tim Cook said in his toaster oven thing, you know, convergence is not always good. it often backfires in ways that you don't think when you're theorizing this thing up. It felt really weird to pay $300 for what was basically a webcam with a fairly buggy app and a unreliable video stream. So I would not recommend the Withings baby monitor. Anyway, turns out. You know, I think I'm looking back now at a week ago or, you know, a week and a day ago when we didn't have a baby. And I'm just thinking, what did I do with all that time that I had every day?
Yeah.
You know, because back then I would look back on college and I would think, what did I do all day at college? I wasn't doing my homework. I was sitting on my computer all day doing something. God knows what. And then before that, I would think back in high school. I had so much time in high school. What did I do all night, every night? You know, I was on my computer doing something. What was I doing? And man, I wish I could just have that much time again. But you know, you never appreciate the time you have. So now I have even less time. And I think this actually might work to my benefit in that it'll motivate me to get things done in the small amount of time that I'm given. And, you know, one thing is, you know, I know Merlin has talked about this before, but, you know, when you are bounded, when I know that I have all week nothing happening to work on something and I have no real deadline in place for anything, you know, or no externally imposed deadline, I won't make good use of that time. I kind of space things out. I spend a lot of time on Twitter and, you know, ticking around. I won't use the time wisely. But if I haven't been able to get work done for a few days and I have like 1 6-hour block where I know, oh my God, I have this 1 6-hour block to get as much work done as I can because in 3 days I have to ship this thing to Apple for something, you know, then I will get so much more work done in that block than I would have if I just had like a whole week of nothing to do. So in this way, you know, I think having the baby now and soon having the child and having all the time costs and time obligations of that, my work time is going to shrink. No question. It already has by a lot. And I don't expect it to grow significantly in the future. I'm going to have less time to work. And so I'm very quickly dumping things that are time wasters. And, you know, so in college, I didn't want to pay for any software or anything. In high school, I pirated everything under the sun because I had way more time than money. Now I have way more money than time. And this is just something that happens as people, you know, as people become adults, they get more costs on their time. This happens to pretty much anybody. It could be different scales to different people, but it happens to pretty much anybody that, you know, once I left college and I started full-time work, that's when I switched to Macs from Windows because I didn't want to dick around with my computer anymore. I didn't want to have to spend so much time reinstalling Windows every 6 months to get it to work acceptably or to keep things clean or to keep things stable. I was really good at all that. I didn't want to build my own computers anymore because that was a pain in the butt and that was a big time cost. And I was fine getting the Mac Pro because, like, you know, eventually once I could afford it, rather than building my own big PC desktop, because it was just, I just got it, it worked, I was happy with it, now you have it, hopefully it still works. You know, I moved towards things that worked better and needed less time from me, even if they cost more money, or even if they were limited in other ways. Which is generally Apple products. You know, they don't often cost a lot more money anymore, but generally Apple products are, you might pay more for this thing. It'll definitely have fewer features than some of the competitors, but it'll work better and you'll have more time to do anything else in life besides this. That's generally Apple's appeal. And now I feel like I've moved even further along that continuum. Now I have even less time, and I'm willing to go without a lot of other things to just save time. And so one of the things I did the other day, I had work to do. I haven't worked in pretty much a week, so I had a lot of work to do, and I have a deadline coming up very, very soon that I want to meet, that I closed Twitter, I closed chat, I closed so many stupid apps that waste my time, even though I enjoy them, just so I could get more work done. And last night, my hard drive filled up in my laptop.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this is ridiculous. I'm thinking now about buying the next Mac Pro. John Siracusa was so right. Like, I'm like, why do I have to deal with disk space in 2012? Because I have a laptop and I want it to be fast, so I have an SSD. But SSDs are small. So I'm like, what do I do? Like an animal. I have so much less tolerance now for dealing with stuff that I don't think I should need to deal with anymore because I have less free time. And, you know, this is important for developers. So many developers are young people who are in college or in their 20s who have lots of time. And developers tend to solve their own problems, or at least tend to solve problems that only impact the world that they see, which is why we have so many websites about tying your Twitter account to your Facebook account to your friend feed mm-hmm. sprayer or whatever. As I was saying on Twitter, like I looked around for a good contraction timer app, and they're all terrible. there's most developers don't see these problems.
Right. It's not a glamorous app for most developers when they think about what app should I build.
Right.
It's not as glamorous.
That app is probably never going to be bought for $1 billion by a freaked out conglomerate.
It's probably so true.
So,
well, that is until Zuckerberg has his first kid. Or does he have one already? No, he doesn't.
I don't know. He has a really cute dog, though.
Well, there you go.
So that dog is adorable.
Uh-huh.
It's one of those dogs that's like, it's like way more hair than dog. It's pretty cool.
That's all dogs.
No, this one's like way, way more hair than dog. He's really adorable. He has his own Facebook page. Anyway, turns out. This is the first time I've actually really, really been very close to hiring a full-time employee to take over the website. The Instapaper website. Because I definitely want to keep working on the iOS app myself. But the website I've been neglecting for a long time. It really needs attention. It really needs potentially a rewrite of the user-facing portion. But at least it at least needs a lot of attention. And there's lots of things I've wanted to do. Browser extensions being one of them. That's a big one. And you know, like a few other things I've wanted, like just website features in general. But I hate working on the website. And now I know it's never going to be a high priority because the little time I'm going to get, I'm going to want to devote to the iOS app as much as possible. Or really, really low-level website things like the text parser. And so now I'm really very, very close to saying, all right, I need to hire a full-time employee for the website. Or at least a high-hour contractor, like maybe like 20 hours a week, something like that. I don't know. I haven't gone too much into it yet. But I what do you think? I mean, most people who I know who are small developers who have hired other people say they wish they did it sooner, that they loved hiring people because they didn't want to spend the money up front, but then they realized afterwards they had so much more time and were able to get so much more done. So I don't know. What do you think? I mean, it cost-wise, I think I can swing it. It's going to be a major cost, though. Basically, I'm going to spend more. If I need to have a full-time employee, that will cost me more than all of Instapaper's hosting every month. So I have to balance that. Like that's Instapaper's biggest cost right now that I would be effectively doubling
mm-hmm.
or more. You know. So cost-wise, I think I can do it. It's gonna certainly make things tighter. But I think I can do it. But logistically too. And what do you think? You've hired people.
I think it comes down to where you place the value on your time. If for me, I can say that, you know, hiring people to, for example, help with editing has been huge. The idea of being able to record a show and then have somebody else who's better than me at editing do the editing. And I have, you know, Jim and Ed doing that. That's been huge. And it's freed me up to think about other things. Now, you know, I there are still a lot of other things that I would like to outsource and other things that I would like to do. Finding the right people to do those things and hiring them and finding the right kind of engagement, you know, it might not be something where you might not need somebody, like you were saying, maybe 20 hours a week. You might need them for more, you might need them for less, but finding a person who's interested in doing that, who wants to do it and who can do it the way that you want. Some people have a really hard, especially in the small business, it's tough because when you're at that point where you realize that you need the help, but maybe it's the first time that you're considering getting somebody else to be involved with your business that you're, you know, it's not just about delegating. It's about giving up a piece of something that was yours and that they're now going to do it. And even if they try to do it your way, it's not going to be your way. And being able to make peace with that can be a challenge for some people. But once you do, you definitely experience the runner's high of, you know, all of a sudden you don't have to worry about this thing. And yes, you're making less money, but how much is your own time worth? Would you be able to make more money if instead of spending, I don't know how many hours, you know, 20 hours a week, if instead of spending 20 hours a week doing that thing, you're now spending 20 hours a week doing something that either A, brings you a ton of joy, or B, brings you money? What are those things worth? Like, I stopped mowing my yard and doing yard work a few years ago, maybe 3 years or 2-3 years ago, because I said, man, I'm spending 3 or 4 hours every weekend doing this, mowing the yard, edging, trimming, weeding, all this crap, that if you were to figure out what my billable rate was and either work or say, screw it, I'm not working, I'm just going to be with my family. Imagine that. What is that value to me? Is it worth the $100 a week I'm going to spend to have like a crew come out and do all this work in like 20 minutes? Yes, it's absolutely worth a few $100 a month to have somebody come out and do this work that they're going to be better at than me. And now I don't have to have like a lawnmower and all this equipment in my garage. I can put more stuff in the garage or get rid of it. You know, all of these things that it returned. That, yeah, I was writing out a check to some people to do something that I was perfectly capable of doing, but just because you're capable of it doesn't mean that you should be doing it. I'm in support of your decision to try it. But here's the other thing is, it's not like you're making a decision that's forever. You're going to try it out. And if it works, keep doing it. And if it doesn't work, like, stop.
Right. Yeah. And I probably should start out with contractors because...
Yeah, definitely.
Hiring somebody full-time makes it a lot more difficult to get rid of them legally and paperwork wise. Like, you know, if that doesn't work out, if you have to fire them or lay them off, there's a lot of paperwork overhead and potential legal problems that you can get there.
Yeah.
That I'm not nearly qualified to talk about, but I know they exist. And so that scares me, definitely.
Oh, and it should. And that's, you know, we've talked about, you know, like your 1099 thing. You know, hiring somebody is huge. And my advice for anybody who's thinking about hiring anybody, unless you're already a big company and have lots of employees, would be if you can make it work, prolong hiring, as in like a full on, I have hired you, you're an employee, prolong that as long as possible.
Like start with contract.
And yes.
Go up from there.
And be very, and it doesn't, you know, you
can. The thing is, when I was an employee seeking jobs, that drove me crazy.
Oh, of course.
Want to do that.
No, you don't want that as an employee. Because you're like, no, I don't want that. No.
But I worry, like, how much will that shrink the applicant pool? And will I be missing out on really good people? Because, like, I know I would not have taken a job like that. Like, when I last looked for a job, which was when I found the job at David Reel, which became Tumblr in 2006, when I was looking for jobs, I required full-time with benefits, like from day one. I would not look any, because I had no money and I had no standalone health insurance. You know, I knew that if I wasn't willing to go without health insurance for a long period, and I wasn't willing to take on take on the massive paperwork burden of filing my own taxes with contractor income only. And I needed the money. I needed a full-time income.
Right.
So,
you needed a full-time thing, but you've already said you're not looking for a full-timer right now in this, right?
If I could find the right full-timer, I would definitely hire them full-time. I believe there's enough work for that.
But see, you're also in, I think, a unique position.
But I also,
people know you,
right? The person I would want
would
be somebody who would be both able to do programmer-type things on the website and able to give it a good enough design. Because I'm fine hiring designers for, you know, contract occasional work, but I don't have the resources to hire a full-time designer and a full-time developer. I have to pick one or the other. And there's enough work for both, really, really, on the website especially. There's enough work for both. So, but ideally, if I can find a developer who has enough design skills to be able to do the website design well enough, and maybe just call in a separate designer for occasional needs or for, like, you know, big picture stuff, that would be great. But I don't even know how to begin finding that person.
Well, this is what I was going to say, is you're in a unique position. You're in a good position because people know who you are. They know what Instapaper is. It's not like you're just like a corner store and you put a help wanted sign up. You put the word out, and I think you'll get lots of people who would say, I'm already doing freelance. I would love to work with you on something like this. I'm happy to get a 1099 check. Let's get started. And by the way, I'm such a huge fan of yours, Marco, that if you want to hire me full time, we can work toward that. If you don't want to, fine, we'll keep it like this. I think there's a lot of people, because you've got a well-known service, you've got an incredibly amazing podcast that people everywhere smart listen to. I mean,
of course,
you're in a different situation. You put the word out, I think you're going to have some people, you know, interested.
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. Well, consider this the word.
So this is it. You want to hire somebody like that. Let's just make sure we outline the requirements.
If I found the right person, that would make the decision a heck of a lot easier. I would say, you know, if somebody came to me whose work I could see, so I could really tell that this is the right person, who could both take over the website development and have good enough design skills that I wouldn't need to hire a full-time designer, that would be amazing. And I don't even need them to do the low level website stuff. Like, you know, all the stuff with, like, low level database access and caching and, you know, the low level stuff, that's all already there. That's already in place. And for future needs of that type, I'm happy to do that because it isn't that much need. And that, of course, also majorly affects my hosting costs. So I might want to still do the low level stuff. But the entire front end, all the website features, really, I have no desire to work on them, and I'm not even really qualified to do that kind of stuff anymore because I haven't done it for so long.
No, I hear that.
It's
outside your wheelhouse. It's outside your wheelhouse.
Whatever that means, yes.
And that was the thing, like when I built all the versions of 5x5, and I pretty much rewrote it and redesigned it for this last one, never doing that again. Not because it was awful, but because it so took me away from focusing on shows, focusing on content, focusing on, you know, even just doing working sponsorship deals and all of that. It took me away from all of those things. And although for a long time, writing software was my core focus, as you say, it was in my wheelhouse.
I always say that.
It was, you know, it no longer is. And this is advice I've given to just recently to a friend of mine. If it's not either bringing you joy or making you money, then it's outside of the things that you should be focusing on. If you simply love doing something and it doesn't prevent you from making money, or it's the core focus for you as either an employee or running a business, then do it. If it falls outside of that, if you're like, why am I doing this? Find somebody else and hire them to do it.
You know who I need? I need a clone of Peter Vidani.
Oh, the European fashion model? Or
maybe that was, you know, him in high school or college. I don't know.
Oh.
But now he works at Tumblr. And I need somebody with his skill set, basically. You know, he has very good design. He is primarily a designer, but he can also code. So either that or the flip side. If you're primarily a coder, but you could also design pretty well.
Right.
I need that. but here. And if Peter didn't still work at Tumblr, I would probably try to hire him. But I don't want to poach from my friend at Tumblr.
But if he's but, listening but if and he were to come to you, that would be different.
No, that would be way too awkward now. But now that I've said all this, but yeah, I need somebody like that. So yeah, get in touch if you're a person like that. I don't think I even need you to be here.
You don't want him in your house. You don't want that person in your house.
No, I mean like here in the New York region. You wouldn't be working in my house regardless because there's nowhere to work, and I have no idea what that would do to taxes and paperwork. That would probably be crazy. But I don't know.
Let's do our second sponsor. This episode so far, sponsor wise, has been all about iPads and typing, because our second sponsor is another iPad typing thing. And this is actually pretty cool. It's a new sponsor. It's an app called Tap Typing. It is a typing trainer for iOS. So I know you're listening to this. You're like, well, I don't need to try. I can type fine. Hear me out. Touch screens and tablets. These things are part of our life now, right? They're here to stay. They're not going away. But most people have never actually learned
how to... What about the fridge toaster?
Well, that's something else. I don't know if this translates.
We'll see.
But people haven't really learned how to type effectively. I mean, I've watched people type on an iPad or an iPhone, and they either fumble around, or they get discouraged, or they figure out how to do one thing, and this is as good as it gets. I'm done. I don't need to learn anymore. But in all those cases, it's just assumed that whenever the keyboard appears on the screen, that they're going to be frustrated now. Well, the Tap Typing, it doesn't have to be this way with them. With just they have these little lessons, just a few lessons, and you can drastically increase your iPad typing speed and thereby your productivity. Typing on the iPad does not have to suck, and it does unless you actually learn how to do it right. You learn how to type when you're in school most of the time on a keyboard. Why not do the same thing here? It doesn't matter. They have lessons for beginners. They have advanced lessons. They have a speed test with global rankings, which is pretty cool. Universal support for iPad and iPhone. And this part is really cool. It tracks where your fingers hit the screen as you type, and it shows you a heat map of where you're making your mistakes. So this is the bottom line. This is your takeaway. The time you spend learning how to type, it's time you invest in making yourself more productive. So get taptyping.com. That's where you go. Download the app, get up to speed. And so once again, here's the URL. gettaptyping.com. Check these guys out. It's very cool. You thought you could type. Now all of a sudden you realize you can't.
I can't. I always thought I could.
But do you want to talk about this WWDC thing?
I want to get to that at the end.
All right.
But I want to first talk about Read It Later and Pocket.
I didn't know if you were going to talk about that. I didn't want to push it.
How could I not?
I don't know. It's your show.
I mean, once Readability came out and I broke the seal of talking about my competitors, I mean, how do I not talk about my biggest competitor doing a really big change?
I don't know.
So, all right. So Read It Later is my biggest competitor. If you believe the numbers they give out, they have about twice the number of registered user accounts. Although I really don't think registered user accounts mean anything, which is why I never really brag about my number of registered user accounts.
Let's tease that statement apart for a minute. Are you saying this is because registered users don't necessarily mean active or real users? Is that the hidden meaning there?
I think registered user accounts on free web services don't indicate much, because there's no barrier to signing up if it's free. So it could be drive-by people who tried it out for 2 seconds and then left. It could be people who, in my case, I have a decent number of accounts from just people who accidentally created a second account. If they mistype their email address and it says, do you want to register this account?
Right.
And they say yes. And then they log in and it's empty, and they send me an email saying, my articles are all gone. That happens all the time. So I know there's duplicates. There's probably... I don't know about Instapaper, because I don't think there's a big target for it. But for other free web services, there's always issues of spam accounts, things created by bots in bulk in massive numbers. So any kind of free web service that tells you a registered user count doesn't really mean that much. It is good to give a general ballpark of roughly how big it might be, but it's so wildly inaccurate, and there's so many other factors that... I can tell you that by registered user counts, Read It Later, Now Pocket is almost certainly my biggest competitor. But that's about all I can tell you because it doesn't really indicate anything else, you know.
It's just a barometer.
And just like my user account, you know, I have like, you know, 2.2 million or something like that. I don't even check the number until somebody asks me about it because it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to me at all because I know from working on web services, I know these things don't mean that much. You know, and you can try to argue about, well, how about number of active users? But then, well, how do you define active? And that, you know, depending on the kind of service you have, that varies quite a bit. You know, what is an active, like a Tumblr, like what was an active Tumblr user? Is it so, like, you know, somebody who posts on their blog like once a month? Is that active? Or is it people who visit the dashboard every single day? Should they count the same?
Right.
You know, like it's a very tricky problem to solve. So I try not to get too caught up in user numbers by any measure. Anyway, the big news is, turns out, the big news is that Read It Later, which was my biggest competitor, didn't do much for about a year and a half. Because first, the founder did an Android version, and I think it took a lot of his time. And then he took on VC money to grow the company, and doing that, of course, took a while, because that taking on VC money takes a lot of work and a lot of time. And so this is pretty much the
biggest... You don't just get a check and just drive to the bank with it?
No. this is basically the first real move that Read It Later has made in almost 2 years. Because they were so busy doing these other things. And by the way, I should point out, I don't have a great relationship with Nate Wiener, the founder of it. And I don't know if it's Weiner or Wiener. I'm just going to say Wiener because I think that's what it is. Not because I'm trying to make a joke or anything. I actually think that's how it's pronounced. But, you know, he and I met. We exchanged some cordial emails a few years ago, basically introducing ourselves and, you know, trying to remain respectful in our competition. And then he trademarked the name Read It Later. And then he sent me a demand a week after the trademark got approved, demanding that I stop using the phrase "read later" everywhere, and that kind of stopped the cordialness of our relationship, cordiality, I don't know, whatever the word is. We haven't really talked since then. But you know, basically, from what I know of the guy, I have to imagine it was driving him crazy that a month ago, when Readability came out, that all of the press about Readability mentioned Instapaper, and none of it mentioned Read It Later. That had to have been driving this guy crazy. I don't blame him. I mean, if he really does have twice as many users as I do, and everyone always talks about my service, and the press so rarely mentions his, I would be annoyed too. I don't blame the guy, you know? But I know that kind of thing always drove him crazy. And so on one hand, so what they did is they announced they have renamed their service from Read It Later to Pocket. And they're focusing a lot on video and photos and mixed media. So, and I knew they were going to be doing that. I didn't know they were going to be renaming, but I knew they were going to be focusing on video. And so it does seem like it was a good idea to rename the service because Read It Later really sounds like it's only about reading, or at least primarily about reading. And I think they're shifting away from that. I think it's very clear that they don't want it to be only about reading. And they even said that their number one saved domain is YouTube, which is extremely different from my usage. So obviously, YouTube, I think, is my number four saved domain.
Can you share your number one?
Number one is New York Times. And number two is Life Hacker. And then like up there in the top 10 is usually like The New Yorker, The Atlantic, LA Times, Wall Street Journal. Like, you know, basically the big newspapers and the big literary magazines, plus like a few big name blogs like Life Hacker. That's what gets up there in my top list. And YouTube is kind of in the middle there, but it's really not number one by any means. Twitter is even up there too, which I think is from some weird clients saving tweets directly rather than saving the links in them. But certainly it's up there, but it's nowhere near my number one. And I think he gave some quote to the press saying that it was number one by a pretty large margin for them. So I think it was wise for them to do this move. So even though Read It Later, we've talked about names in the App Store before. As it goes, that's a pretty good name because it's so descriptive. It fits on the App Store rows, in the App Store tables where you search for an app and it lists apps. it fits there without leaving Lipsis, as far as I know, anywhere. And it describes what the app does very well. That has always, as far as I know, that always worked well for them. But they're effectively abandoning that name. And that's worth talking about. Outside of the fact they're my competitor, which is going to be hard to, you know, separate from this mentally, but outside of that, I think that's really worth talking about. That's interesting for developers. They had this great descriptive name and they abandoned it. And I think one of the reasons was that they are focusing more on video now. But I think it was also that they didn't really have the press recognition that they should have had based on that user number. They didn't have it. It's, as I said, like they, all the stories about readability, they would even say, and this had to drive Nate crazy, they would even say, read it later type apps like readability and Instapaper. And like they would even include the phrase read it later and not mention his app or link to it. So obviously, even though it seemed like it was a really good name, maybe it really wasn't. Maybe that was not working for them very well. It certainly seemed like there were some black holes of recognition for them in the press. So that's really interesting to me that they had this great name and now they've abandoned it. And I don't know, maybe they'll stop yelling at me if we're using Read Later, who knows? That's interesting to me. And anyway, so a lot of people have asked me, because now, and so they released this new app, and I haven't used it that much. I just basically glanced at it because I've been a little bit busy recently. But it sure sounds, it looked to me when I tried the app that they added very few features to the reading interface. That the bulk of the work in this new release of the app was a reskinning. You know, it has a new visual theme, so like a reskinning, and the grid list screen, you know, on the list of articles screen, that has been significantly rewritten, and now it's this kind of flipboard like grid of lots of crazy stuff, focusing a lot on pictures and everything. But the reading interface really has not changed much at all. If you use the app before and you look at it now, it's really extremely similar. It's just been reskinned in the reading interface, but almost all the features are identical. Almost no features have been added. And yet, they got so much press and so much attention for how good this was. Even Sean Blanc, who you would expect would be like, you know, an Instapaper fanboy if that kind of thing would exist. At least I bet people would expect that of him. Even he said, wow, this is a really great app. Now, I wonder, does that make Nate even crazier that now he's getting all this attention for this app that is very similar in many ways to the old app, but just has a new name and a new skin? That's got to be driving him a little bit nuts. But anyway, not to poke fun at the guy, but I think it's interesting how much this rebranding and reskinning mattered to them. It got a lot of attention, and they've been featured now in the App Store. Basically, the exact same feature readability got last month, they got this month. So this is a ton of attention focused on my competitors and boosting them up. And they're, of course, now free, but that doesn't really... I mean, that wasn't a surprise either. So people have asked me a lot what this means for Instapaper. You know, do I need to respond somehow? Do I need to make my app free or add video features, etc.? I've talked a lot about making the app free and why I don't do that. So that, I don't think that's interesting for today. I do want to talk about video features and why I don't claim to be video-centric, and why Instapaper does not offer many video-related features. So one thing is now, Read It Later, now called Pocket, they have video support to an extent, which is basically special treatment of bookmarks that are considered videos, so YouTube and a few other sites. But they don't do offline saving of videos, for a very good reason. And the reason why they don't do offline saving of videos is the reason why I've never offered video support much beyond what I have now, which is when you're talking about video support in this kind of app, this is not a general term. Like, I'm not saying I'm saving articles from content everywhere. You know, video is YouTube. YouTube is something like 90% of whatever videos people watch. It's at least probably more than that. YouTube is completely dominated by, I mean, video is completely dominated by YouTube. So when people say video support, what they really mean for the most part is YouTube support, with a few little fringe sites on the outside, but for the most part, we're talking about YouTube here. And this is extremely different from articles, because even if, so I said my number one site, say it was New York Times, even if the New York Times blocked me or sent me a cease and desist, told me, no, we want to opt out of TechParser, we no longer want New York Times stories saved. Even if they did that, my number one source is, it's only like 3% of saved articles, because there's such a long tail there. It's a huge long tail. Sorry for people who hate those terms. But video, it is not that way. Video is extremely focused on YouTube. And even if it wasn't, it's still only focused on a handful of very small sites. You know, it's YouTube, or very small, it's YouTube, Vimeo, and, you know, Metacafe, and a handful of other ones, but very, very few. And almost all of it's YouTube. So if I offered a video feature, a video focused feature, if YouTube sends me a cease and desist, or if for whatever reason I can't offer YouTube support anymore, that feature is dead. I mean, that's a major deal breaker for so many people. So the reason why I don't offer video support like that is because it's too fragile. And more importantly, so Pocket doesn't save the files for offline because they can't. Like, legally and policy-wise with YouTube, they won't let them. And so here's an app that's focused on offline saving of things, or, and, you know, reading them later, but, you know, offline has always been a pretty major part of this kind of app. To say you offer video support and not offer offline saving of those videos, I think that's going to disappoint a lot of people.
Mm.
And, you know, it's kind of similar to when I built in a local search box in 3.0. I think it was 3.0. I added just local search with like a little database index. In the app, you could search the content of all the articles that the app had downloaded. It was all just local. There was no server-side cost. And people really didn't like that, because I got so much feedback from that saying, this doesn't work right. Or, you know, why isn't this searching all of my articles? Because it was searching just the ones they had downloaded on the device, but to them, they saw a search box and they expected it would search all the articles in their account, their whole archives, everything. Not just what was downloaded locally on the device, which is, you know, a couple hundred articles. So that was a feature that I added, this kind of half-assed feature that I should never have done that. And I later removed it because it was causing all these problems. And I have since replaced it with a real server-side search that works the way people expect. But that the reason why that didn't work for me, that feature, is because people saw a search box, they expected it to search everything. And it couldn't, and it didn't. So with video support, I feel like if I offered video support, if I advertised that as a major feature in my app, I would get a lot of very angry people who were very disappointed that it didn't work offline. And so what I do now is a very, very simple support, which is, if I detect that you have a YouTube link saved,
mm-hmm.
I simply render it differently in the table. I will, if I can pull a thumbnail, I attempt to pull a thumbnail for it, and I'll stick the thumbnail in the grid. And if I can't pull a thumbnail, I'll at least put a little play button there. And if you tap on it, it launches the YouTube app natively. I believe that is the best approach that I can take right now, because that is like, that can never be blocked, and, you know, it will always work the way it expects, and it'll take advantage of everything the native YouTube app does. Which, if I tried to build that into my app, it would never be as good, because it would never have all the features the native YouTube app has. So that is the level of video support I'm comfortable providing. Besides that, I don't think I need to do that much else. Maybe that'll change over time, but as far as responding to this, to Pocket's new focus on video, I don't think what we do is actually that different. And I'm sorry for anybody who thinks that's a gross simplification, because I really haven't tried the new version of Pocket much at all. I gave it like 5 minutes because I was busy. But as far as I can tell, what we do isn't that different, but the messaging is very different. And it's very much not a focus for me. Because our usage is different. You know, they said, one of the quotes they give is that 60% of saved items are articles for them, which means 40% aren't articles. That's a lot. For me, the number is very, very different. I haven't run the complete stats yet, but it's way, I have way more articles saved than that. People are just using my app differently. So it doesn't make sense for me to advertise this heavy video support when I can't really provide what people really want, which is offline support. And I'm very happy staying focused on articles. So, do we have another sponsor? Because I'm changing chapters here for a minute.
Yeah, we do actually.
All right, let's do one more, and then I can talk about why I pay attention to Read It Later, but not other competitors.
That's what I was gonna ask you. I also wanted to ask you. We'll do little. You know, they do this on TV. They do a little teaser. They drop. They drop the hint of like.
Stay tuned,
and you'll hear about that. You know. Find out how this weekend's weather will affect your plans. Our final sponsor for this episode is Squarespace.com. Now, I was telling you about them not too long ago, but there's something big. There's something big that they have now that's brand new. Free custom domain names. Okay, so what is Squarespace? First, let me just tell you that. It's everything you need to create an amazing website. Hosting, analytics, 24/7 support. Domains. This is a big deal. Every annual
that is a big deal.
And biannual account. So you sign up for your, and now I'll explain how you sign up and all that in a minute. But if you sign up for a year or a 2-year thing, not only do you save a whole bunch of money because it winds up being like $8 a month, but you get a free domain of your choice. You register it all right in there with them. You get the most complete website service possible. It's amazing. It really is amazing. It has all of, I've told you about features a bunch of times. I'll tell you a little bit about them again. You get full control over your content. You get full control over the site customization. You build a website, you create a blog, and this is their number, but I believe it because I've done it. 10 times faster. 10 times faster on their comprehensive platform. This is fully hosted. You don't have to worry about scaling. They scale everything. You want to do photo galleries? They've got that. You want to learn more about your visitors? They got analytics. You have an iOS device? You have an Android device? They got mobile apps, hand-built from the ground up. You want to import your blog from WordPress or TypePad or Blogger or Movable Type or wherever you still have it? They'll import it right from there. I could go on and on about this, but here's what you need to do. You need to go to squarespace.com. And when you sign up, there's a code. Now, today, it is still April. There's a couple days left, I guess, in April. They keep doing that to us. They keep adding days to the months like this, so it's hard to keep track. But until
these
April...
emperors.
I know. You thought that whole feudal thing was... anyway, Dan sent me 4 because April is the 4th month. As soon as we get to this next month that I hear is coming up, you will switch it to Dan sent me 5. So try both of those depending on when you sign up. And it varies. Now, here's the thing I want to explain. Depending on how long you sign up for, that is going to determine... But it's going to save you so much time. Your life is going to... Remember before, Marco, we were talking about outsourcing. Outsource the hosting of your website. Don't do that anymore. Make a beautiful site that lives somewhere you don't even have to think about it anymore.
I can't believe anybody is still hosting WordPress themselves.
Seems crazy.
Like, that's crazy to me. I see people when I mean, there, you have so many options now. I mean, and here I am boosting up Squarespace. I'm the co-founder of Tumblr. It's a direct competitor, but obviously, look, I don't care which one of these you pick. Nobody should be running their own copy of WordPress anymore. That
doesn't matter.
It's so much of a pain. I see people who are like, who are, you know, running their own sites, who have like moderately popular sites, who are saying, oh yeah, I have this like this big CDN that I have to pay for, and I have these like 4 servers for my blog. I'm like, what? What do you need all that crap for? I serve my entire site with static files off of a VPS. It's $20 a month. I mean, it's like I can't even imagine people spending all this money and time, like patching WordPress installs and all that stuff.
Well, I'm moving everything away from that, with the exception of 5x5, which is everything else I'm moving away. So month to month, you can pay, it's like $10. Okay. You sign up for a year, you save 20%. You sign up for 2 years, you save 25%. And you get 10% more savings on top of that if you use Dan Sent Me 4 or Dan Sent Me 5. So go to squarespace.com, check it out, make these guys proud that they sponsored us, and we appreciate it.
So I want to talk about, coming back from the break.
Yeah.
I want to talk about why I pay attention so much to Read It Later and readability, but not other competitors. So I have other competitors. I mean, off the top of my head, there's Evernote Clearly, which Evernote's a huge company with a huge user base. So Evernote Clearly is probably more of a competitor than I think it is. There's Apple. There's the Safari Reading List and Safari Reader. That's built into every iOS device. It's right there in the browser. It has far better placement in the browser than my bookmarklet ever will. It has far, because Apple does not open up. Like, you can't add a button to Mobile Safari. You can't add a menu item. There's no way for developers to do that. There is no share button to Mobile Safari that would list apps. There's no open in. There's nothing like that. So the only way people like me can get into Mobile Safari is with bookmarklets, which are terrible. And the installation procedure is ridiculous that almost nobody can do. So, you know, Apple's a huge competitor, even and it's 100% free. Spool is a big one. There's Float, which I believe is still owned by Scribd. That there's a little bit of a history there, but it's not worth getting into. There's Clipix. I heard a commercial for Clipix and Howard Stern. I'm like, I wanted to advertise on Howard Stern. And then here's Clipix saying, you can save articles to read later. I'm like, what? So there's that thing. I don't pay attention to any of those, but I pay attention to Read It Later and readability. Why? You know, one issue, you know, readability I was working with, so I was familiar with them, and Read It Later has always been big. And for a while, Read It Later was my only real competitor. So there's some history there. But maybe, you know, all these other ones have come along, and I don't pay any attention to them. Maybe I shouldn't pay attention to any of these guys anymore. You know, what is it gaining me by watching what these two big competitors do? As far as I can tell, readability is not that big anymore. Once their iTunes feature ended, they fell pretty far in the ranks. And well, and we'll see what happens with Pocket also. They, you know, that the same thing might happen to them. I don't know. But you know, right now I don't really need to pay attention to readability because they're not big enough to be taking a lot of my customers away. And I don't think Pocket is either. You know, I got off Twitter messages saying I'm finally dumping Instapaper for Pocket, or yeah, you know, same thing with thanks guys. Thanks for telling me.
Yeah. You know, and that's the thing.
I have so many customers who were just so desperate to leave.
Oh yeah. And that's the thing. It's like for whatever reason, I hear this a lot with what people in the listening base seem to think of as competing, you know, internet broadcast, right. Broadcasting. Like, can't you like both? Or why does one have to lose for the other one to win? Anyway, I hear what you're saying. I found
the word dumping is about as common as the word useless with people's
right.
non-humane comments to app developers. Anyway, but you know, it isn't a big number here that I'm talking about. And, you know, it's like a handful of Twitter at replies here and there over the last couple of weeks. So as far as I can tell, you know, my sales are still decent. They're not amazing, but they're still decent. You know, maybe this is my Twitterific moment. In the sense that, you know, Twitterific used to be the only game in town for native Twitter clients. I'm pretty sure it was the very first one. They kind of invented the category, didn't they? Is that accurate?
I would say it's accurate.
I think using Twitter back then, so I don't actually know, but I'm pretty sure that's the story.
I think they were the very first ones that could do it for sure. Yeah. Yep.
Right. Like they pretty much invented the native Twitter client, and they owned that category for a couple of years. They were really they were like the best game in town for at least a couple of years. And so I have to look back. Maybe I've had that time in my space now. Like I pretty much invented, I mean, if you ask, never mind. I pretty much invented the space. And you know, and I've been dominating, at least in the press, even though Read It Later has had more user accounts on their servers for a while. I've been dominating in the press in attention for this category for the last couple of years. But now maybe my time in the spotlight is passing. Now, you know, other people are coming by. I mean, I can't even imagine how many employees are being paid to work on apps that compete with me. Readability has like, you know, 6 or 7, something like that. I think Pocket has like 10. I mean, there's Scribd and Spool and Evernote and Clipix, all these other things, like these are all companies that are paying employees to fight against my app for the market share that my app has so far held. That's a whole bunch of guns aimed at me. And again, I could take on VC money and expand and fight back on that order of magnitude, but I don't want to. That's not the kind of business I want to be in. And these other people, you know, if they get big and if they can sell to Google or somebody, they'll probably end up making a lot more money than I will. It's arguable whether what I'm doing is smart at all. What I'm doing might be the stupidest move ever by staying small, by not making everything free and not taking on VC money. Everyone else who does those other routes has a much better chance of making a lot more money than I will over time. But that isn't the kind of business I want. I want, right now, look, I just had a baby. Right. I work at home. It couldn't be any better of a situation when you just had a baby to work at home for yourself on something that doesn't take that much time. Really, like realistically speaking, I didn't work on Instapaper at all for the last week. The server stayed up. Everything is fine. I'm working on a new update to the iOS app, but I did most of the work before the baby came. And, you know, for the most part, the business is fine after not touching it for a week. So if I made a change to a different kind of business, if I took on money and if I hired a bunch of people and if I wanted to race to get as many users as quickly as possible with no revenue and then figure out revenue later, that's a very, very different business. And that, I was in that world at Tumblr.
Right.
And there's so, I enjoyed it. I learned so much from it, but I also know very much what it entails. I know it's a long-term fight. I know that it, you know, Instagram is very unusual. People are thinking about that now, but believe me, that's very, very unusual of an outcome. I know what that world is. I know what it requires of me, and I know that I can't give that right now. I can't give that level of stress and time and focus in my life when I had a brand new baby. You know, look around at startup founders. Most of them are people in their 20s who don't have a family yet. There's a reason for that. It's not that you can't do it, but it's that it's a really hard balance that almost nobody really can do well. I'm sure there are counterexamples, but there's probably very few of them, you know. That's a whole different world. And, you know, look, if Tumblr ends up selling for a gazillion dollars, I'll be fine with money. I don't need that much money, really, to lead the lifestyle I want to lead. I don't need to sell my startup for $100 million. I just don't, like, what the heck would I do with $100 million? I don't. What would you do with $100 million? I mean, like, would it be that different from what you would do with $10 million? These are crazy numbers. Some people are in that mindset where they want to grow as much as possible. 10 million isn't enough. Let's go for 100. Let's go for 300. Let's go for a billion. That's great. I'm not that kind of person. I just don't care that much. I'd be very happy to get $10 million and call it a day. You know, I don't care that much about being the biggest thing in the world. And so, you know, I don't want to make that my business. So if somebody else comes in, or in this case, if many other people come in and start taking that portion of this market of people who want everything for free, or who at least will start out with free, and they get really big and they get acquired for a few hundred million dollars by somebody, that'll sting a little bit, but I still feel like I'm making the right decision here by not going that route. So we'll see. You know, again, we'll see what happens in practice if that actually does happen. But I just really don't think that's what I want. And as long as my business can still operate, I mean, Twitterific still, you know, Twitterific is no longer the most popular Twitter client. And they, if you look at what I just described, that pretty much happened to them, which is a whole bunch of other people crowded into that marketplace. Now, one of the best Twitter clients, which is the official one, is free. And many other ones have free versions. I imagine Twitterific's business today maybe isn't as good as it was 3 years ago.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure it can't be. But then again, you know, there are a lot more iOS users.
Right.
So
it's a much bigger pool.
It's a bigger pool. Yeah.
More Twitter users. So, you know, maybe it is. I don't know. But, you know, it doesn't seem like they spend a massive amount of time investing into it. But it's still a business for them. As far as I know, it's still, you know, it's still paying some bills, at least. So, you know, if Instapaper becomes that level of, you know, it'll still pay the bills, but it's not dominating any more of any of the press, or it's not making as much money as it does now, I'm okay with that. You know, I mean, I've been doing this for 4 years, and I don't have any time to do anything else. Maybe if I want to do something else, maybe, you know, maybe it would be good if somebody came along and reduced me to some small sliver of the market. I don't know. I guess I'll find out if that happens. I'll see what happens then. But, you know, having the baby has really made me reevaluate a lot of things. And
good.
Certainly, yeah. And although not my car. And certainly, I don't want to change what I'm doing now with my business. I don't want to go, you know, all free and get revenue later and try to get as many users as possible. I don't care. As I said almost an hour ago, I don't care about user counts. I hardly even look at my user count. You know, I want to make the best product possible, and I want to keep doing what I'm doing now for a while. Maybe in the future that'll change. I'm sure it will. Eventually it will change. Something, you know, nothing lasts forever. I think there's a lot left to do with Instapaper. And in the worst case scenario, you know, I was thinking, like, if my app sales ever really dried up, you know, like if they really shrunk down to the point where it was very difficult to sell a $5 app anymore, I would probably give away the app for free and then just make more things require subscriptions. But if you ever see me do that, that probably means that I'm not having good app sales. Because right now the vast majority of the income comes from app sales. You know, that the $5 app that provides the vast majority of Instapaper's income. But, you know, if that ever goes away, if that ever becomes just not enough to really make it worth it, I have other options. I can push subscriptions. Right now, subscriptions pay all the operating costs. So if my app sales were ever so hurt by all this competition that it was no longer feasible to keep charging $5 for the app, I could still run Instapaper. Assuming subscriptions, you know, held, I could still run the service. It just would no longer be worth it for me to keep pouring more and more of my time into making it better. But it would still operate, and it would, you know, get minor improvements here and there. So, you know, that would be fine, you know, and that would free up my time to work on other things. But I don't want to work on other things right now. I want to work on this. So right now I want to keep doing this, and I've been doing it for 4 years. I could easily do it for at least another two. You know, we'll see what the business holds. I think if you want me to keep working on this, buy the app. No, I think the business is fine right now. There's certainly there's more competition than there's ever been, and there's more pressure than there's ever been in the marketplace against me. But so far, it's working. And it'll keep working for at least a little while longer, probably a couple more years at least. So back to the original question of whether I need to respond to this new competition, I don't think I do. And I really don't think that I need to pay attention to my competitors as closely as I have. Because what they're... I mean, look, if Read It Later is getting 40% of their items saved not being articles, I have to wonder how much of the same market we're really in. And readability, you know, I think they have more overlap for the type of usage than Read It Later does with Instapaper. But I also think that they're too small right now for me to really pay that much attention to. You know, I don't need to care what they do. And by the way, the readability guy sent me a baby gift. I mean, that was pretty nice.
No.
You know, I got to give them credit. That was a pretty classy thing. So thank you guys. I was very surprised by that, and that was very nice of them. again, as I've said about them before, by the way, I don't think the readability people are not bad people. I just think, you know, they tried this thing that didn't really work with the payment system. So I don't think I need to pay that much attention to these competitors anymore. I think I'm just going to do my thing over here. I'm going to do my own thing. I'm going to make the app. I'm still going to be doing what I've always done, which is I'm going to make the app that I want to make. That's a luxury I have, that by not having any bosses, by not having any investors, I can pivot to whatever I want. I can make massive changes in the app. If I want to delete an entire feature, like I did with RSS folders over a year ago, I can do that. That was a major feature. And I didn't feel right about it for so long. And it sucked about the app. It sucked for lots of reasons. You know, I can make big changes like that. I can make the app I've wanted to make. One thing I've thought about, and this is drastic. Some of the press, when people were complaining about readability stealing page views, some of the press rightly pointed out that there are ways to get stories into Instapaper without viewing them. That is true. The API allows that. When you launch the app, if you have a URL on your clipboard, it pops up a dialog asking if you want to save that URL, which now both of my competitors, I believe, have copied that feature, but they missed a few details. you know, that's a way you can copy a URL without viewing it and send it in. So there are ways to, you can email in a link. And of course, almost every RSS reader and Twitter client supports a way to send in a link via the API that you haven't viewed. There are ways to do this. One thing I've thought about, if there was ever a major problem with that, or if the press ever really turned, or if publishers ever really turned against that ability, I've thought about discontinuing all those features and only having the bookmarklet and browser, which are two ways that I can basically verify that you are viewing this article right here. Because what the bookmarklet and the built-in browser do is they send a copy of the page you're viewing to the server, and it's stored. Legally, that is like the safest possible way to do this legally.
Right.
Because you are basically acting upon the user's direction to save what they're viewing here and give it back to them on their demand, just to them. You're not giving their copy to other people to get around like a login barrier or something. You know, that's like my major contingency plan, where if there's ever any major problems with these features that allow people to add things without viewing them, I can just switch to that. I can just discontinue all those features. That would very much hurt Instapaper, though. That would really hurt the API use cases from RSS readers, from Twitter clients. That would not be good. But it's like this contingency plan. If I ever need it, I can do that. My competitors, by the way, don't have that infrastructure. They don't save the content of the pages that you view. They don't send the content from the bookmarklets. They could start that, of course. Nothing stopping them. I mean, I did it. They could do it too. But I at least always have that contingency plan. And because I'm so small, if there ever comes a time where I want to do that, I can just pull the trigger and I can just do it. I don't have to ask my board. I'm not going to be destroying $100 million of value, you know? Like, I can just do it. And making those kind of big changes like that, I like the freedom to do that myself. That allows me to make this app to be exactly... I've even thought about just closing down the website and just having the website only be able to add articles and have all article management be in the app. Because the website does, you know... As I said, I hate working on it. And neither of those major changes are things that I intend to do right now. But if things change majorly in the future, maybe I might need to do one of those things. I could do it. I reserve the ability and the authority to make major changes like that. And it's just so much harder to do that when you're stuck in a big company with big backing and a big board that's breathing down your neck to grow the user base by another 10% this month. So yeah, maybe this is my Twitterific moment. I don't know. Time will tell, I guess.
Yeah.
But right now, I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing because it's letting me run the business the way I like to run it. And it's letting me make the kind of product I want to make. And we'll see what happens.
Okay. Well, good
luck. I do
want
to talk briefly about WWDC.
Yeah, so the details for people who haven't been maybe
this
listening.
This is a Syracuse-length episode, but that's fine. I warned you about that.
Yes, you requested that, so we rearranged some things. For those who haven't been tuned in, the last couple episodes that that you were on before the baby came, you had said that there is absolutely no way, and you've written a post about this on marco.org, but there's no way that WWDC will be the week of June 11th through 15th, 2012, because you have inside information that there is another big company that will be going in that spot at Moscone, and you can't say who it is. But and the real reason that you didn't want it to be that week wasn't due to actually having information about it. It was that's when you have your birthday barbecue. And it's been ruined the last couple of years, and they should just move it. They should not have it then. It should be earlier or later, but not during your birthday week. And unfortunately, it looks like you're going to have your barbecue in San Francisco.
Yeah. Well,
assuming you got tickets. It's assuming you even got tickets.
I did.
Oh, good.
Everyone has bad sources.
this is how you ferret those out. Now you know, don't trust those people. Yeah. At least when it comes to WWDC predictions.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, a lot of people have talked about how Apple should address this problem of WWDC tickets selling out so quickly.
Yeah.
Obviously, demand far exceeds supply. And 2 years ago, they raised the price by a few $100, but it didn't seem to help at all. I think it used to be $1,300. Now it's $1,600. Doesn't matter. You know, realistically speaking, what are they going to do? Like, the whole conference, once you add in the hotel and the flights from pretty much anywhere, you're spending like $4,000.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter whether it's like $300 more or not.
Right. who is that going to stop? Maybe some local people only.
Like, if there are 10,000 people trying to get in at $4,000, are you really going to have that many less at $4,300? So anyway, I don't think there's much they can do while leaving at the same kind of event. Now, everyone has these ideas and they say, why don't they X, Y, or Z? People, it's easy to be like a backseat driver. It's easy to say, why doesn't Apple or whoever do it this way? They're so stupid, I can't believe they haven't done this. Or, why don't they just do this? People make these suggestions or demands often without thinking of, okay, well, what if they did that? What would the ramifications be? In what ways would that fail if they did that? So one thing is the lottery system. People suggested, they should give out tickets by a lottery. And if you win the lottery, you go. And if not, you don't. That would anger so many more people that and then there's how do you manage the entrance? And there's potential legal issues there. I mean, it's like, oh, that has so many more issues. What if they split up the conference and have like a Mac and an iOS separately? Well, unfortunately, iOS is probably in much, much higher demand. So you would still have one conference that was ridiculously quickly selling out and angering everybody. And then you would have Apple's people need to take 2 weeks off of their job because Apple sends something like 1,000 people to it's something like that. Like the Apple staff at WWDC is a lot of people. And it's a lot of important people because it's like people who work on UIKit and the backend stuff and developer evangelists and all these other people. There's a lot of very important Apple employees who have to take a week off effectively to do this conference. So for Apple to host more conferences doesn't really alleviate the problem. They could raise the price again, but how much would that really help? And then that has other issues. What if, if they doubled the ticket price, if it became like $2,500 or $3,000 for a ticket, that would anger a lot more people, I think. And it still wouldn't really solve the demand issue. You'd have to raise it pretty high to solve the extreme demand issue here. I think what they could do is simulcast the video streams. That would help in the sense that, because you know, and right now they do make the videos available like a week afterwards or 2 weeks, which is very fast considering the amount of work that has to go into it. That's pretty good. But my problem with that, like I've had access to the videos now for something like 3 years because I keep going to the conference.
Right.
I find that I hardly ever watch them after the conference. The conference is, it's an event that you attend. You give yourself a week to go out there. You know that either you or your boss have paid for this, have paid a lot of money for you to be there. Especially if you pay yourself, you really feel like, well, I better go. And you go and you attend, and it's an event that you pay attention to that week. Your job that week is to attend the event. Afterwards, you have these like, you know, 25 hours of videos or something that you can watch. But when are you ever going to do that? For me, I find I hardly ever did, unless I needed to reference a specific thing that I have this bug or this something or other, this problem, and somebody says, oh, they covered it in this one video last year. Go check it out at like the 25-minute mark. Okay, I'll go do that. But it is a major event that when you go to it, your job is just to attend. So you do. But if I, you know, afterwards, if I'm at home that week, or if it's later on in the year and I want to get the value of that, I'm so unlikely to go back and watch that video and practice. I'll download it. I'll intend to watch it, and then I never will watch it. Right now I have like 5 or 6 of them saved of sessions like I didn't or couldn't attend last year that I wanted to see. I would say, okay, then let me you know make a note to get this video when it comes out in 2 weeks, and I'll watch it sometime during the year, and I never do. And I bet I'm not the only. I bet this applies to a lot of people. I bet I'm not the only one here. So, you know, if they create more ways to watch the videos faster, like if they live cast them, live stream them, or if they have like overflow rooms and the buildings across the street or whatever, there are other things they could do like that that could expand the capacity somewhat, you know, effectively. But it's not really the same experience at all. And you'd still have just as many people demanding these tickets, and they would still sell out in 2 hours. So I really don't think they can really do much. You know, there's this massive event that they hold that tons of people want to attend. They hold it in one of the biggest venues in the region, and you know they could spread out to multiple buildings and stuff. But then you get the South by Southwest problem of it becomes a really massive, disconnected conference. You lose a lot of the social benefits, and it just gets this sprawling mess of different buildings and taking buses between them and all sorts of weird stuff. That's not a very good solution either. So I don't know what they can do. I think what they tried to do this year, they tried to lock down various ways that people could buy multiple tickets unfairly. So they did like, you know, a limit of 5 per business and a limit of 1 per individual Apple ID. So you couldn't have scalpers easily. So you couldn't like, you know, buy 10 tickets knowing that you're going to be able to sell 9 of them on eBay for a massive profit. I'm sure there were still ways to do that, but it certainly was a lot less. So, you know, they have done some things like that. Obviously, though, this is still a massive demand for the supply. And I don't think there's much else they can do. I think they probably could have picked a better time of day. I think doing it at 5:30 in the morning Pacific was a bit cruel to people on the West Coast.
Yeah, it almost made it so that anybody who was local to WWDC would be unable to attend it simply because it was so... I mean, nobody's waking up that early. And a lot of the people who had, you know, we've talked about this, signed up for those alerts, never got their alerts or didn't get them in time.
Yeah, actually, I had my own alerts from Pingdom that I mentioned before. Those came in within minutes. I think I received those alerts, and by plural alerts, it sends me both a text message and a push notification to the Pingdom app. That way, if AT&T is being crappy about text message delivery, I still get notifications if my servers go down. So I was using that same infrastructure. So my phone, I know if it's like, you know, 3 in the morning, I know if I hear 2 text message sounds in a row, that's a really serious thing I have to get up for. Anyway, I received those notifications about 5 or 6 minutes after the tickets went on sale, which is pretty good. I received the WWDC alerts notification after I'd already bought the ticket. So I don't know exactly when it came in, but it was a good like 20 minutes later, I think. And I don't know whether that was, you know, them being overloaded, or just just AT&T being crappy about delivering that message that one time, or from some queue somewhere being overloaded. Whatever the reason, relying on somebody else to alert you of this might not be fast enough if they're really selling out this quickly. So I don't really know. Like, I don't know what the solution to this problem is. I think, I believe as John Siracusa, I think, said this week, I don't know, they're all blurring together. I've been listening like half awake on dog walks and stuff. I believe what he said was, you know, Apple's style is to not tell you the solution that they have until it's done and until it's a good solution, and just not even address the problem until that's the case. And I think maybe that's what they're doing here. Maybe they have some better idea of how to do this conference in the future. But I think ultimately, I think honestly, they don't. I think they are just as puzzled as me in this conversation about, you know, how do we really fix this? One thing they started doing in recent years, they have these tech talks that go around to different cities, usually every winter. I think they've had it for 3 years in a row now, or maybe 2 years, I don't know. Where they basically go, they send a smaller team of like 6 or 7 people, something like that, or at least like 6 or 7 presenters, and then maybe more staff. But they send a smaller staff around to various cities around the world, giving free 1 day condensed WWDC like presentations. And I attended one of these 2 years ago in New York, and it was great. It was very, very similar to WWDC. The same quality of talks, just shorter ones and more condensed, you know. And I think there were 2 tracks rather than like the 4 or 5 going at once at the big conference. They were great. And I think one of the reasons they did that was to alleviate demand for the one big WWDC conference in the summertime. You know, if they go around to lots of various other places at a totally different time of the year, and they give these shorter little mini conferences for free, that should alleviate lots of the demand. But that also takes time away from them. It takes these people who do these things. You know, the developer evangelism team is pretty small, and they all have to go on these trips basically. So they're like traveling around for weeks out of the year doing all this stuff. And they're, you know, preparing these talks, giving these talks, managing these talks, and all the logistics of planning these little mini conferences. That has to be at least a few people's full-time jobs to just put these on. So that is a major undertaking, but I think it's a very, very good way to solve this problem. This past year, the ones that came around like this December or January, whenever they were, they did something even better, which is you could request a ticket, and then they would prioritize the requests based on if you had an app in the store and if you did not attend WWDC. So if you were shipping an app and you didn't attend WWDC, you would get priority and get a ticket first in these tech talks. So I tried to get into the New York one and I couldn't, probably because I went to WWDC. So I think that is a very good way to alleviate the demand, but it's never going to alleviate it enough to avoid these fast sellouts. I just don't think it's going to happen. So that helps a little bit. It might even help a lot, but they might just need a lot more help. You know, it might be that much more over demand for this thing. So I don't know what else they can do, but I'm sure they have some ideas, and I'm sure they're working on it, but it wouldn't surprise me if there wasn't that big of a change in the future, if this is just how it is.
Time for change. The time for change is now.
Or never.
Now or never. But that's it. You feel like this has been a good show. You're returned. And, you know, one thing I want to mention, two things I want to mention. The first one is just the fact that you're here doing a show. There's a lot of people who would say it's only been days, really, since the baby came. Why do the show? Sure, I understand you've got to keep servers going and things like that. but why do the show at all? Why work any extra than you have to?
Well, that's an easy one. As I mentioned earlier, I really enjoy writing. Writing is, if I have to give up everything else for some reason, like if I burn out on development and I just can't do it anymore for whatever reason, I will still write. I love writing. And I feel like I have to write. I've said before, it's like taking a big dump. Like if I don't write for a long time, I really get antsy and I almost get depressed. Like it sucks. I need to write. I need to get my thoughts out. And I really enjoy that. And if that's one thing I hope at least that I will never do anything to compromise my integrity as a writer. You know, even running these RSS ads that I've been doing for the last few months, that I was uneasy about that at first. I'm like, is this going to compromise my reputation, my integrity? And I think it doesn't, because it seems like a common enough practice, just like having any advertising on the site. So I think it's okay. But that I really agonized over that decision. Writing is very important to me. Similarly, I love doing this show. I really was upset that I couldn't do the show last week. I really wanted to. And if our baby was not born on Monday, a few hours before the show was would have been aired, I think I would have still done it.
Mm-hmm.
I really love doing the show. And so I didn't want to stay away for long. And realistically speaking, you do most of the work. I just call in. So it isn't that much time for me to do this. It's like an hour and a half a week of my work. Or 2 hours today. But usually it's like an hour and a half a week. So I love doing the show. And I want to keep doing the show. And even if I don't have time to code, I will make time for this. And I will always make time to write.
Okay. And the second thing then, if that's all, I mean, it was very decisive. I wanted to, you know, people need to react. And the last thing is, because so many people have been asking this on Twitter, and this is the show where we've really talked about it the most. I thought I would just mention it here briefly. The 5x5 app was submitted. It was reviewed. It was approved. And it will launch at the time I of my choosing.
Oh, you did the hold for developer release.
I just set a future date.
That's a good move.
Yeah. The reason why is there's a few things I want to do behind the scenes. I've already significantly updated the streaming server, both the capacity and bandwidth and all of that stuff. So that's ready. There's a little bit more that I want to do to optimize a couple of other things, and it's, you know, and then I'll release it on a day where I'm not, you know, going to be recording any shows so that I can observe it and make sure that everything is going well. There was also, I have a lot of comments from people who are saying, don't release the app for free. Give us an opportunity to pay you, give us an opportunity to donate. And I just want to be clear. Although we talked about the pros and cons of releasing it as a free app, I just want to be clear. I could never release it as a free app just because of the associated costs with running streaming and building the app and a whole lot of other things. So for those of you who are now saying, of course it should be a free app, I hate you, I'm sorry. And for those who are saying, please give me an opportunity to pay, congratulations, it's going to happen.
That's good. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah. It has to. I never considered having it as a, just for the record, I never once considered it being a free app because it would lose too much money. So
yeah, app has, because the live listening, that has a significant cost on the back end.
Oh yeah.
Plus the cost of making the app to begin with.
That's And again, we talk about outsourcing. I am not an iOS developer. I'm sure that I could, I've been programming long enough that I am sure that I could become a comp with enough time investment that I could be a competent and maybe even a good iOS developer, but that doesn't make sense for me. So I paid somebody else who is already a competent iOS developer to do it. And he did a great job. So there you go. Anyway, sorry to, throw that in there,
but like $4. I think you could do $4.
I
know last week I said three. I bet you can do four.
Okay, well, I'll keep that in mind. That will be the mystery then. People will be able to debate that. And
five is tough. I got to say,
it won't be five. It will not be five.
Feel, it's starting to feel like 10 felt when I launched. Like, it's starting to feel like, I wonder how long I can hold this price point.
It will not be 5.
There's a lot of pressure to drop it. No. We'll see.
Yeah. So listen, congratulations again. I'm sure everybody in the audience is excited for you. And we hope to... so now, should we still follow you on Twitter, or should we follow your son instead? Who's going to be more active as a tweeter?
Well, my son is a baby, and so he can't tweet much. I don't want to necessarily be that kind of person who like talks for my son on Twitter. I don't know how comfortable I feel with that.
Here's what you can do.
It just seems wrong somehow. Like it's not wrong morally, but like it seems inaccurate. You know, so follow me, and once my son is able to tweet himself, then maybe I will promote his account more.
Sure. Well, here's what you can do. You can,
if Twitter still matters by the time that happens.
Yeah, and you never know. I mean, you really don't know. But here's what you can do. I'm going to put. By the way, I've been putting links into the show notes. The whole length of the show, you can go to 5x5.tv/buildanalyze/75. For all of the show notes for this particular episode. And we want to say thanks to the burliest men in software development, the makers of HelpSpot.com, which is the best help desk software available, for subsidizing that. But I have that, and I have the different monitors that we talked about, and all of that good stuff will be there in the show notes for your enjoyment. But what I was going to say is, you could do what I've done, is my son does have a Twitter account. He does not use it. But whenever he says something that's especially funny, if I remember, I will tweet it.
Oh, you quote him on it.
I will quote him quoting his own. It's you know, like, eventually you won't have your own account. Your handlers will tweet for you on your behalf.
Right.
Send a tweet. Tell the people, you know, that kind of thing. And that's what I do for my son. It's like, you know, I manage it for him. When he's old enough to take it over, if he's interested, well, he'll do it.
Cool.
Do that. So anyway, I put that in the show notes. If people want to follow him, there's no reason that they should not follow him. And they can follow you at Marco Arment. You've got to add the Arment on there. When I was frantically checking to see if you're, to see if you had a baby yet, because you kind of left me hanging and you left me not knowing, I would frequently type in just Marco. And there's some other guy's face. I'm like, why is he doing
some other guy?
Get out of here, other guy. Give it to the rightful owner. But it's Marco Arment on Twitter. I'm Dan Benjamin on Twitter. And there's also a 5x5 Twitter account. You can follow that too. And rate the show. Rate it in iTunes.
There's even a Marco_org Twitter account if you even want to follow that there.
Wow. You're crazy. You've got the whole Twitter thing cornered.
Oh, yeah.
All right, everybody. Have a good week. Thanks for tuning in.
You too.